welcome to the second episode of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. I'm Perry Middlemas and he's David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hello, Perry.
We'll start off with a little bit of a fix-up from what happened last week. With our first episode, we didn't do too badly, but there was a couple of things that I wanted to mention. One in particular was we put a few notes on the website, and David incorrectly identified himself as being the chair of the 1975 Worldcon. This was pointed out by our good friend Kerry Hanfield, and we then went in and changed it, so we're all fixed up. But it led me into thinking, David, that you being chair of the 85 Worldcon, I knew about that. I know about a lot of other things that you've done inside fandom and inside your reading career. But where did it all start for you? Where was the thing that kicked you off way back when for you to be able to get into being a reader and a writer and into fandom?
That's a good question. Well, a little bit of background. I won't go on at huge length. I grew up in the 1950s, working class family north of England. Neither of my parents had much of an education, but they were both keen readers. And so there were always books in the house. We never had a huge number of books, but there were always books of various kinds in the house. And they read to me as a child. I think everyone starts off who wants to be a reader or who's interested in reading and writing is read to as a child, I think. I can remember some books from my childhood. Noddy. Remember Enid Blyton's Noddy? I remember those. I used to have a hardback volume called Buffalo Bill's Big Book of the Wild West.
No, I didn't have that one.
Which had drawings of various Indian chiefs, Sitting Bull and so on. So that was interesting. I remember a book called Corky the Circus Boy. It was a TV series. You remember that TV series? Well, it ran in England. It was about a boy who'd grown up in the circus. His father was a clown, or his adopted father was a clown. So
were you still in the UK at this time?
Yeah, it's all still in the UK.
Yeah, we see TV series in the UK. I know we had a lot of ABC early days, but I didn't get TV until 1963 or 4.
Yeah, okay. This would have been
a fair bit after.
Yeah, this would have been 56, 57, I suppose, something like that. 1956.
We just dreamed of television in those days. Didn't even know what it was.
Oh, well, you're in the colonies, you know, that's what it's all about.
It was even worse than being in the colonies. I was not in the outback, but in mid-north South Australia.
No.
In the boonies.
The outback.
Just about.
Yeah, that's right. But I think the book which really got me into, really sort of spurred my imagination was Enid Blyton's Magic Faraway Tree. Which was sort of really got me stuck into the whole fantasy magic sort of environment when I was a kid. I always remember the scene in one of those books, the Faraway Tree books, where there's a really snotty girl who's looking down her nose at all the other kids. And they go to this magic place and someone offers her an ice cream and she can have any flavour she wants. And so she very cynically says, "Well, I want sardine-flavoured ice cream." And she gets it.
As you would.
She gets it with little fishtails sticking out of it.
Oh, yum.
So that's kind of what really got me into that. And then, Children's Library, lots of books on myths and legends, that sort of got stuck into that. Edith Nesbit, or E. Nesbit, as she wrote as Five Children, Story of the Amulet, those books were getting me into the whole fantasy realm. And then finally, when I sort of graduated a little bit higher, I got into what you call real science fiction, but still sort of juvenile science fiction. Captain W. E. Johns, who wrote all the Biggles books. I never read much of the Biggles books, but he wrote a series of science fiction stories too, which I read. James Blish's Spin Dizzy series, They Shall Have Stars, and those books. Those were in the juvenile library, which is interesting. And then a lot of comic books. I read vast numbers of comic books.
Good to hear.
So, Dan Dare in The Eagle, and then things like Superman, The Flash, Green Lantern, those kind of books.
Did you have the problem like all the rest of us did that read comics when we were younger, that everybody said to you, oh, don't read that stuff, it'll rot your brain, you'll never basically become a reader if you read that stuff?
No, not at all. And the thing was, my father had always been into that kind of story. So when I got a little bit older still, I started to get stuck into his collection of books, which included heaps of Edgar Rice Burroughs. So Princess of Mars, John Carter series, and Tarzan. I think I read every Tarzan book. Which is quite something.
There's a lot of them, I believe.
There are a lot of them. The Land That Time Forgot was a series by Edgar Rice Burroughs, which is one of those lost world stories where there are dinosaurs and things. But it had some interesting elements to it, if I recall. There was different species of human which had evolved, including some which were more advanced than our current human. So they were quite fun. And eventually I graduated to the adult library and got stuck into all those Galanx SF books, you know, the yellow-covered books. Every time I went and looked for a book, I'd look for those yellow-covered Galanx books first.
Oh, yeah.
Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein. Yep. I read Arthur C. Clarke's City in the Stars by the time I was 12, I think, which is pretty mind-boggling for a 12-year-old. That's really what got me started into the whole science fiction, fantasy sort of realm. Eventually came to Australia, got into Tolkien, and started collecting books of my own. And that's why when we last moved, I had 78 boxes of books to move. Much to the dismay of the moving company.
Yes, I've done that a couple of times. They get a little bit annoyed when they realise they've got so many, because it's a heck of a weight.
Yeah, they weigh a lot.
Having to shift, they're not too keen on it.
No, that's exactly right. One of the movers though was quite impressed. He was a young man from the subcontinent of India, I think, and he sort of in a sort of awed voice said, "Are you a scholar?" Sort of. But yeah,
well, that's so always the way. But it's interesting that you note, which is what I didn't know about you, was that, and this will lead into something that we'll talk about later on in the episode, that you'd read a lot of comics when you were growing up, when you were younger, in your formative reading years. And it's interesting to note, I don't know of a single person that read a lot of comics back when they were younger who did not then go on at a later time and read massive numbers of books afterwards. Nobody that I know that was a comics reader at that time stopped reading after high school. Mm. And that seems to be the thing. People stop reading after high school because they're forced to read all this crap for English lessons, which they all hate. They never get given anything that they really are terribly interested in, and they just stop. And then you basically end up getting these people that say, well, I haven't read a book since I left high school. Mm. Well, that's really sad. But I don't know anybody who started off as a comics reader, as I did as well, who isn't now a big reader and didn't go on and read all the way through their life. So it's a very interesting point at the beginning.
Yeah, that's right. I think the other thing about reading comics like Superman and so on, and eventually I got into the Marvel comics, Spider-Man, X-Men and all that sort of thing, Fantastic Four, that they're fundamentally science fiction or fantasy. And so it really pulls you into that whole mindset of being interested in other worlds and space travel and weird things that can happen. So it is a good grounding, I think, for science fiction.
It's, a lot of people have said the golden age of science fiction is, what, 12 or 13? Oh, namely, funny. that being the time when you hit that level of imagination that you can carry on with, and everything expands after that, and suddenly everything opens up. Yeah. So you're moving away from some of that young adult stuff and then moving into slightly older stuff, and you're moving into different parts of the library and you're finding things and that you're allowed to read, and your father suddenly says, yeah, I think you can read this now. This is all right. Probably wouldn't have given it to you 2 or 3 years ago, and everything changes.
Yeah,
so it's quite an interesting time.
Yeah, certainly 12 years old is certainly the age to read Edgar Rice Burroughs, because once you get any older than that, you can't go back and read it. It's such awful stuff.
There's a fair bit of stuff around that we could possibly name from the pulps that probably would be fit that very, very closely as well. It's not just Edgar Rice Bubbles, as we always used to refer to him.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It was the way it went.
Yeah.
All right. Good. Thanks for that.
We mostly think of science fiction in terms of novels and short stories, but there's an increasingly popular form in between those two extremes. So, and that's the novella. And I believe that Perry's been reading a lot of SF novellas recently. So what is a novella, Perry, and why is it a good format?
Well, it's a good thing for you to bring up. There's a couple of series, actually, of novellas that I've had the pleasure of reading over the past few years that I wanted to talk about. But first, a bit of background. As defined by the Hugo Award rules, a short story is a piece of fiction of less than 7,500 words. A novelette lies in length between 7,500 and 17,500. A novella between 17,500 and 40,000. And a novel is a work of fiction of greater than 40,000 words. Now, a lot of these lengths are fairly arbitrary, but in order for the Hugo Award categories to work properly so that works are placed into the lengths that would be suitable to be compared against others, you have to have some length versions. So a novella fits into that realm that can be considered either a longer short story or a short novel.
Yeah.
Let's say somewhere between 50 and 150 pages of print. That's not exactly correct, but it'll do as a boundary marker. It just gives you an idea of how big it is we're talking about. A lot of those early pulps, for example, that you were talking about earlier on, were in that 125 pages to 170 pages. I've been reading a few of the Maigret novels from the 1930s, and they're all around 125 pages in the new Penguin classic, in Penguin reprints. They fit pretty much within a novella range. But science fiction and fantasy have always had a bit of a love affair with a novella length. And some critics are of the view that it perfectly serves the genre. In any event, it provides a writer with enough length to build a three-act story without the requirements of a big supporting framework of massive amounts of world-building or backstory. You can get to the point fairly quickly, set everything up, go to your second act, and then have a finalization of it without having to spend 500 pages dealing with the nuances of what the palace structure and politics is all about.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an SF writer working at the novella length, you need to be concise. And frankly, with some SF and fantasy writers, as we've just said, that's an ability I wish was a little bit more common. Some of them go on at far too much length. Now, the novellas I want to talk about here are perfect for the length that we've described, perfect for the 100 to 140-odd pages. The first series is by Martha Wells and is known by the collective title of The Murderbot Diaries. There are four of these novellas so far. We're always thinking about, especially in the SF and fantasy fields, that some of these series can go on further, but I'm just talking about where we're up to at the moment. The first of them, All Systems Red, was published in 2017, so we're only talking a couple of years ago, and went on to win both the Hugo and Nebula Awards for that particular year. And then Artificial Condition, Rogue Protocol, and Exit Strategy were released in 2018, with Artificial Condition, the second of them, now on the ballots for the same two awards this year, that is the Hugo and Nebula Awards.
For the novella length.
Yeah, all of the novella length. So basically we're talking here that they won the awards in the novella length, the first one in 2017, and the second one's been nominated in 2018 for the novella length. Now, the series follows the exploits of a part-human, part-robot cyborg, which we first meet when it is assigned as a security agent for a scientific expedition on an alien planet. It calls itself Murderbot for reasons we soon discover, and it has been able to disable its governor module that allows it to be controlled by humans, thereby making itself practically autonomous. While it actually likes humans, it doesn't really want to be friends with them, partly because they could die at any time, but also because it would prefer to download and watch an almost endless supply of television soap operas. From such things are characters drawn, and that's what the whole point about these novellas is about. It's all about character. The cyborg saves the expedition from attack by a giant native animal on this alien planet, and has then discovered that relevant scientific information, various maps of the planet, have been deleted from the original survey pack by persons unknown. We're now moving into setting everything up. It appears that someone is attempting to either destroy the expedition or get to the cyborg, or more likely both. We soon discover that the Murderbot once malfunctioned and killed 57 people. That's hence the name. And that the plot to capture it is far more complicated than a simple snatch and grab. When the expedition finally leaves the planet for safety, the cyborg slips away and sets off to find out why someone or something is out to get it. So that's where the rest of the series of novellas kicks off. You set everything up at the beginning, you get all of the character development, you get the plots all set up, and then off it goes into the other novellas. Now, the novellas here are told in the first person by the cyborg, which makes for an interesting point of view and provides an immediate sense of drama and tension. All of these four novellas are worthy of people's attention. I think that they should be read. Basically, as you see, they're being nominated for awards. They're important in the field at the moment, and reviews right across the board have been generally very, very favourable for these. Occasionally, you'll hear somebody say something which is a bit derogatory, like, oh, I've seen all this stuff before. Well, frankly, I've read a fair bit of science fiction, and I haven't. I've seen parts of it before, but the overall thing stands out. Similarly, for the Binti series of novellas by Nnedi Okorafor. Now, Nnedi Okorafor is a name you probably haven't heard very much of. She's an African-American writer living in the US and has been working over the last 5 to 10 years, though don't quote me on that, given that I'm only just trying to figure out what's been happening in the SF field over the last 20 years. I'm only coming across these things fresh. And this is a new name that you need to know about. So there have been three novellas published in this series as of this date. Binti in 2015, Binti Home in 2017, and Binti The Night Masquerade last year. The first, Binti, won both the Hugo and Nebula Awards 2 years before the Wells novella, so you can see that they're fairly contemporaneous. And the third is now on this year's Hugo novella ballot. So the third of the Binti series is up against the second of the Murderbot novellas. So we're getting back here again about the one of the reasons why I wanted to review these was to and bring them to people's attention is that they're on the Hugo ballots this year. Now it's obvious that both readers and writers of science fiction rate these works highly. The first novella in this particular series follows a young African woman, Binti, who is accepted to study mathematics at the prestigious Intergalactic UMSA University. I hope I pronounce all these words right, because sometimes you just never know. She is the first member of her ethnic group to receive this honour, but knows immediately that her family will not allow her to go, as tradition holds that all members of the group stay close to home throughout their lives. It's just the way they work. Binti, however, will have none of that and wrangles away onto a transport ship heading in the right direction towards the university. On the way, the ship is attacked by an alien species known as the Meduse, who murder all the human occupants on the ship other than Binti. Well, of course, you have to basically set something up. She then finds that she can communicate with the aliens using an old piece of technology she brought from home and the clay from her homeland, with which she ritually covers her face and hair, has specific Meduse healing properties. Binti eventually makes it to the university and acts as an intermediary between the humans and the Meduse in negotiating a lasting peace. The sequels follow Binti's voyage home with a Meduse companion, her subsequent troubled relationship with her family, and the interactions between the Meduse and the humans on Earth. As with the Murderbot novellas, the main point of interest here is the development of the main character under stress. We've seen similar things in SF before, but I, for one, don't remember seeing anything previously quite like these characters drawn so well. So there's two sets of novellas, seven in all, that basically are worth people following up and having a look at.
That's very interesting. What's interesting in particular about the two series you've talked about is the fact that they are series. Mostly I've thought of novellas as being standalone items, like the classic The Dragon Masters by Jack Vance was a novella of that sort of length. But I haven't heard before of many authors taking the novella form and then using it to build a series on. I imagine they'll eventually be put into a combined volume.
Yes. There's one thing that I wanted to bring up, that generally what is going to be happening with these, and I think it's already happened with the Binti series, is that she has them combined them into one book and added an extra story into the collection as well. Now, I don't know whether she's pitching that as a novel, in other words, basically a fix-up, as it's been referred to in the genre, or whether she is actually just putting it together as a collection. So a collection of novellas plus another short story, here's another book. So whatever happens, each of the novellas as you read them, because they come out in 1 year and then it's followed later, a year, 1.5 years, 2 years later by another, you can read them as standalone pieces of work. And from that perspective, they're published as standalones, and so therefore you can read them as such, and they are nominated for awards in a similar way. You get a fair bit of enjoyment out of the individual novella, but reading them all and putting them all together also helps, and it's good to read them all in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
The Murderbot ones in particular are definitely going to be need to be read in sequence, because there's a full overarching story arc that runs from the first all the way through to the last. Now, I made a point about saying that there were four in the Murderbot series so far, and that was the pointer about the fact that there may well be further ones of these coming up. There's another series of novellas that's on this year's ballot by, forgive me again if I get the name wrong, Sinan Maguire, which is a series of fantasy novellas titled The Wayward Children. The third one in the series is up on the ballot this year. I believe there have been four in that particular series, and she's continuing to write more into the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's happened is that maybe there's been a bit of a backlash about really big, massive tomes that take forever to write. Maybe authors decide that if they can break it up into novella length, they can get a continuous stream of income and a continuous stream of interest coming in. If we were to take the idea of the longest span that we could think of at the moment between one novel and another, namely George Martin, if he didn't have the Game of Thrones TV series sitting there in the background, would the same level of interest be in those stories now as there is with the TV series? I don't think so.
I think
they would fade in 6 or 7 years, heck of a long time. But anyway, these series of novellas, certainly worthwhile looking at, and I would heartily recommend them to everybody.
Very good. All right, I'll certainly look into that. I think I started one of the Murderbot's stories, but haven't pursued it as yet, but I will. I wanted to talk about a science fiction book called The Power by Naomi Alderman. It's published in 2016. And the reason that I decided to read it was that I saw that it was on Barack Obama's reading list for that particular year or the year following, I suppose. And given that he seems to have pretty good taste, I thought I'd give it a try. So it's a very interesting premise. It's one of those unlikely but interesting and intriguing premises. It's a science fiction novel set in the modern day. But the premise is that women begin to develop an organ which gives them the ability to deliver severe electric shocks, like electric eels. So it's a similar sort of organ that an electric eel has that builds up an electrical charge and that can then be delivered at will. So these shocks can be severe enough to send someone unconscious. And in fact, with certain women, these shocks can be powerful enough to kill. Only a few girls demonstrate this ability at first. It starts to, I think the first couple of instances of it happening are fights between schoolgirls, where one schoolgirl zaps another with this power without realizing what she's doing. And suddenly the other girl is on the ground screaming. But it gradually becomes clear that all female children are becoming endowed with this new organ, and that some older women already have the power to do that. So this is the power. And of course, the whole point of this twist on reality is that for the first time in history, women have more physical power than men.
Men have
always been able to overpower women with their muscles and greater height and strength. But now with this new power, women have an even greater power and can, in various instances, overpower men. And, of course, society begins to tremble because of all this. So I won't go into huge detail about the plot and where it leads, except to say that it doesn't depict a female utopia when women control the world. It's a good deal more knowing than that. Once the power is widespread, the author shows that women can be just as political and just as cruel and exploitative as men can be. But it's an interesting idea, and it holds up, the whole point of it, I guess, is to hold up a mirror to our current male-dominated society. And I mean mirror not in the sense of a simplistic swap over of roles, but in the sense of holding up a reflection of ourselves, something to look into, to examine ourselves very carefully. And in doing so, she makes you really think about our current gender relationships and the things that we take for granted. So it's very disturbing, but very timely and book, and very, very well worth reading, I think.
I noticed that it, yes, I know you were going to talk about this one, and I looked it up and I realised that it actually won the Bailey's Women's Prize, which was used to be referred to as the Orange Prize, back in 2017. Mm. So it's picked up a fair bit of cachet outside the genre, so it's out there. The Bailey's Women's Prize would normally be considered just a straight literary prize, if we put air quotes around that one, but obviously it's picked up a lot of following, and as you say, you have certain interested readers, Barack Obama being one of them, are able to put it on their recommended reading list. It's probably not too bad.
Yeah, well, it's very well written. It's very well written, and it really sort of makes you sit up and start to think about the way we men take things for granted, in particular. But it's not an anti-man diatribe. It's very much, well, if things changed, what would things be like, and what use would women make of this power? And there's a good storyline running through it. It's not simply a treatise. There's a good storyline following some interesting characters through the course of the book. So yeah, I do recommend it.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll look forward to that one at some stage. Don't know where it's going to fit on the reading list, but it'll get there at some point.
Indeed. Perry and I have been thinking about the concept of the theme in some science fiction stories of the generation starship, the idea that in order to get to another planet at less than light speed or in normal space without invoking wormholes or other magical things to get us past the speed of light problem, the idea is that you send a starship off to another stellar system in which you expect that it will take many generations, that you set off with a number of volunteers and they have children, eventually die of old age on the ship, and their children may have children and so on until they eventually arrive at their destination. Similar concept is the idea of everyone being put into some sort of suspended animation or frozen sleep. So we're going to talk about both of those themes. In looking up the theme on this SF database, the encyclopedia, one of the stories that it mentioned as being one of the first to come to deal with this subject is a story called, I suppose it's a short novel, called, or probably a novella, The Voyage That Lasted 600 Years by Don Wilcox. And that's actually available to read free online. I'll put it in the show notes. So I read, I skipped through the story, but I kind of read it. That's interesting because it's a kind of combination of the two ideas I've mentioned. It's mainly a generation ship concept, but there's one particular person who's put into frozen sleep and woken every 100 years to keep people on the straight and narrow and to guide them in Earth's cultural background and so on. And of course it all goes very pear-shaped, and he keeps waking up to find things have degenerated into rather a mess. So it's quite an interesting story. The other one, which is pretty much a classic, is a story called Universe by Robert Heinlein. I think it's probably also a novella sort of length. It was put into a volume with another work put into a volume called Orphans of the Sky. But the basic concept of Universe is that such a generation ship has set off and headed off for the stars. But where the story picks up is mid-voyage, where they've been going for several generations, and for whatever reason, the people on board have lost all concept that they're actually on board a ship. Their universe is the ship, and they have no concept of anything outside the ship. There's been all sorts of mutations happen due to problems with the nuclear drive, and these mutations, these muties, are sort of a former rebel force on the ship. Eventually, I think that there is a point where they do recognize that they are on a voyage and that they need to make preparations to reach their destination. And then we have, this is kind of a diversion because it's about frozen sleep rather than a generation ship, but it's the movie Passengers, which features Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt and a couple of other characters. That's interesting that you have this long voyage happening, a couple of hundred year voyage going on, and all the passengers are in frozen sleep. But partway through the voyage, there's an encounter with some sort of nebula or electrical storm or whatever you like it to call it, and problems start happening with the ship. Things start to go wrong. And one of the things that goes wrong is that Chris Pratt's character's frozen sleep module goes wrong, and he wakes up. So he wakes up, and it takes him a little while to work out why there's no one else around. But he wakes up and then realizes that he is by himself, and the voyage still has got another 100 years to go, 99 years or something like that to go. He's not going to survive until they actually arrive at the destination. And so he goes slightly crazy. He's suffering like being in solitary confinement. He's all by himself. He's got no one to talk to. He drinks a lot. There is actually an automated bar run by an android called, what's his name? Arthur. And he sort of makes friends with this android, but he's not a human person. And but eventually he goes so stir crazy that he decides he needs to wake someone else up. And so he walks around all the frozen sleep capsules and eventually picks on this beautiful woman who's Jennifer Lawrence's character. Her name is Aurora in the book. His name's Jim. And he wakes her up. He's an engineer. He knows enough to mess up the electrical systems and force her to wake up. And, of course, he doesn't tell her that. And he tries to keep that fact secret, but eventually the truth comes out, and at which point she realizes what he's done to her. So that's the concept, and I think it's an interesting moral dilemma that he's put forward. It's not even really a dilemma; it's a moral, it's a crime. Really, it's a moral crime of what Jim does to Aurora. You can say that it was due to him being so alone and so miserable and going slightly crazy. But then he does take this very deliberate action to wake up this other character. And, of course, she then realizes that her life has been destroyed. She's not going to make it to the destination either. And all her plans for what she was going to do when she arrived at the other stellar system have been burnt away. And so when she discovers the truth, she really goes slightly crazy herself and hates his guts for good reason. But then the story goes on. If it had stopped there almost, or if there was some outcome of that, that would have been interesting enough and an interesting story to talk about. But what happens, and I'm going to give away spoilers here, so if you haven't seen the movie and you want to see the movie, skip this bit. But essentially, something keeps going wrong with the ship. The ship is in more and more trouble. They have to do something to fix the ship. Jim goes out on a spacewalk to try and fix the problem, and nearly dies, and she actually brings him back. In fact, he has died, physically died, and she eventually is able to put him in an auto-dock kind of machine, and using all sorts of resources, bring him back to life. And of course, the question is, why has she gone to this much trouble to bring him back when she hates his guts? And of course, then we have this nice, lovely ending where they fall in love again, and all is happy at the very end of the movie. All is... The people who have arrived at the final destination come out and discover that the whole ship is full of greenery that these two people have planted, and they leave a message about how wonderful their life has been and blah, blah, blah. You get the idea. But it's that to me is a real cop-out of the moral issue. And it's also very, we've just been talking about gender roles and so on. It's a very typical sort of male-dominated storyline of he's gaslighting her, he's not telling her the truth, but somehow she still falls for him, even though he's a heel. It's just a storyline that's been played up many, many times, and it's a bit sad to see it still in the modern day.
Yeah, it was one of those. It's a certain possible outcome for the story, but it was the smaltiest one and the most Hollywood one they could possibly come up with.
Yeah.
And maybe it was the one that was most acceptable to producers of the film, because they didn't want to go down the moral dilemma of what do you do with two people that stuck on a starship and can't go anywhere, and they had each other's guts. Where do you go to from there? Because she does at one attempt get so close to actually killing him. I don't know where. She finds this metal bar next to his bed, and she comes in and starts beating him up on the bed when she realizes what she's looking at, the rest of her life stuck on this ship. And she starts literally punching him in the face and kicking him, and then she finds this metal bar. Don't know what it's doing there. But anyway, and she threatens to kill him with it. And he basically just sort of lies back on the bed and goes, well, okay, I deserve it. If you want to do it, do it. And, of course, she can't. Hmm. And oddly enough, it reminded me of a scene from Shakespeare's Richard III, okay. which is quite peculiar when Richard has killed in the play.
Oh, yes.
Not necessarily history, of course. But Richard III has killed a woman's husband. The funeral pyre, the bier is going past with the coffin. He's trailing along and he starts talking to her. She says, you killed my husband. How dare you? I love you, says Richard III. I hate you, I hate you. So he hands her his sword and just stands there and opens his arms up and says, well, if you hate me that this much, why don't you kill me?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can't, because you can't just basically go, oh, well, I'm a good human being, good and moral human being, and just out of the middle of nowhere, I'm just going to beat the crap out of you or stick a sword in your gullet. You just can't do it. So,
yeah, so that was that's a good
thing that brought up about that. That was just one thing that popped into my head.
Yeah, that's a good
But as you say, there are a large number of other possible conclusions to this particular movie, but they chose the one that most people would look at it and go, yeah, that's the most saccharine one they could have come up with, and the most Hollywood romantic one they could come up with, and everything was hunky-dory and everything was great at the end. And I thought, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Not quite as good as it could have been.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So
there was a whole dark side of things they could have gone to. They just completely just turned their back on.
Yeah,
a bit sad.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. And you can say that was he justified in waking up another passenger because he was going stir crazy? Possibly. But then you've got to think about the fact that he went hunting for the prettiest woman he could find and woke her up. You know, so there's a moral.
It wasn't just anybody.
No,
it wasn't just anybody.
Right. That's right.
Now the whole point about it, we should say they did actually sort of make this a decision that he was going to make, because he did actually try and wake somebody from the crew up first, but they were all stuck behind a door that he was not able to get access to.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wasn't able to get anybody from the crew. And while he's a sort of an electrical or mechanical engineer, he was then left with the rest of the passengers. And the rest of the passengers that he was going to choose from was a large group of passengers that were just traveling from one world to another. So they wouldn't have had any specialized knowledge to be able to help him. But it's interesting the way that he went about and did it. And yes, it became a very predictable film near the end when you start seeing where things are going. You hope it goes down one particular way, and it just doesn't. It just goes that's completely
exactly
down
right.
the other way.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So from here, we're going to segue. It's a good word, segue. Jennifer Lawrence's character in the movie is called Aurora. And now we're going to talk about a book called Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson. Now, that you're a big Kim Stanley Robinson fan, Harry, and I'm not. So tell me why Aurora is a good book. I have read it. We've both read it. We disagree about it. You tell me why it's a good book.
Okay. Well, look, I'm fully aware of what some – I'm fully aware of a number of Kim Stanley Robinson's, if you like, failings as a writer. I don't consider them failings in this particular book. In the most recent book, Red Moon, they were a lot more obvious. Stan Robinson basically likes to give you info dumps. Mm-hmm. That is large slabs of material, large slabs of information about the background of the story, which he dumps into the novel and puts it in for you to basically, as a reader, consume and then go on and read the rest of the plot. If it's done well, it's great. If it's not done well, it puts a dampener on the forward thrust of the plot. It makes it just slows everything down. It sort of just seems clunky. Red Moon, he actually at one point, which is actually quite an interesting book, because it's based mostly about the way the Chinese are going to colonize the moon before everybody else, which is basically pretty much what they're talking about at the moment, because the Chinese have now landed a craft on the moon and they are now talking about wanting to set up a lunar base on the South Pole of the moon. A lot of reasons why you go for the South Pole as though other things, but mainly it's to do because there's possibility of water there. Anyway, what he does in the book Red Moon is he actually has a chapter which is told from the point of view of the moon itself. And that's how he builds up the whole history of what the moon is and how it all came together. Okay, all right, I know what you're doing. Maybe it would have been best to skip that one. In the book Aurora, which is a generation starship, because the ship is left Earth, it is travelling over a 200-year period between the Earth and the destination. There are a large number of Earth-style modules on this particular starship with people living in them, and they are living in them for the whole length of the period. So there are the people that get onto the ship at the start of the journey who are not going to be there at the end. There are people that are born during the journey who are not going to be there at the end. And we meet our main character in this particular book, Aurora, where it is a young girl coming through, learning her way about how the whole ship works. She is at the end of the journey and is going to be able to make it through to the end. So she needs to learn how the whole of the starship hangs together and what's going to happen when they actually get to their destination. There's a whole lot of backstory that Stan Robinson has to give you, and he would normally do it in an info dump. But what he does in this instance is that the Generation Starship is run all the way through from beginning to end by an AI, an artificial intelligence. The artificial intelligence over 200 years does actually evolve to some degree. And when one character starts talking to it, he starts asking the questions of, so what's happened? Tell me the story of this particular starship. And the AI starts telling the character what's happened to the starship and how it all hangs together and what the major parts of it are. And that's how Robinson builds up his backstory, basically having the AI telling the story of the journey and the whole of the process and what's going to happen when they get there and so on. And that's what he does with that. And that actually works in this particular instance. It doesn't always work, but this is a really very good device for being able to do this. Now, there's a number of other things that Stan Robinson has bought into this particular novel. Small little pieces of modern research about evolution. If you remember the hobbit species that was discovered on the island of Flores, not far from Bali, probably 10, 12 years ago, it was discovered that this island was completely cut off from just about everywhere else, mainly by the ocean currents, that things that landed on the island didn't get off. You couldn't get off it again, basically because of the way the currents went. And the humans on the island, when they got there, gradually evolved over thousands of years or hundreds of years to be quite short. Same thing happened with a number of the animal species. I believe that there was a dwarf elephant on the island as well. Now, Robinson has incorporated part of that theory or new theory of evolution into his novel by basically saying that things move very, very quickly and things can change very fast in a small isolated environment. And he starts talking about how viruses and bacteria get to the point where they evolve much more quickly in an isolated environment than they would on a large planet scale. So really what ends up happening is everything changes very, very rapidly near the end and the whole thing is coming apart at the seams. So I think he handles it very, very well. I'm fully aware that Robinson, with the with his Generation Starship theme, has put a scale and put everything on one side about moving off the Earth and how you can do it and staying on the Earth on the other part of the scale. And he has put his thumb very heavily onto staying on the Earth side. So he's basically put it that you should stay on the Earth, fix the Earth up, rather than attempting to leave. So that's his view of how the Generation Starship stuff should be working. I like it as a novel. I think it works. I know you don't. Probably for some of the reasons that I've given as to why I quite like this, and you probably don't like that style at all. But that's fair enough.
It's with all of his books, and I've tried to read a number of them. I think I got all the way through Red Mars, but never got into the following Blue Mars and Green Mars. Oh, the other way around. I can't remember which way around.
Green, yeah, it is green, then red. Green, then blue. Green, then blue. Sorry.
What I find about his books, and the one that really turned me off a while ago, which I just literally stopped reading, was 2312, I think. He's got these characters who travel all over the place, and he's got a terrific imagination for what the solar system could be like. But they seem to wander all over the place. The plot doesn't seem to actually get any momentum because he spends so much time lovingly describing the various places that this character goes to. It's a kind of peripatetic novel where they travel from one place to another, and there's lots of description about the places, but I don't ever feel that the characters develop. And it's pretty much the same with Aurora. Some very good things about the book, and I'll talk about one of the good things in a moment. But it is his main character grows up as a child on this ship. Her mother, I think, is the chief engineer at the time and has to try and keep the ship together. But she spends a lot of time wandering from place to place around the ship, learning about different places, having dinner with people, drinks with people. Seems to keep going on and on and on. And then you've got this great slabs of stuff that come from the AI. So it's that masses of exposition that I just feel slows down the whole story. So I'll say what I think is good about it. The good things about it are the concept you mentioned, that things can go wrong with the ecology of a system like that. The ship is really on its last legs when it gets to the new solar system, or to the new system that they're going to. And then they discover that none of the planets of the system are going to be really viable for a colony to be established, for various reasons I won't go into. So, and when a group of them then sort of turn around and try to come back to the Earth, and there's a couple of things about that which I can mention too, but never mind. When they get back to the Earth, what they really bring up is the moral problem of sending off a bunch of volunteers on a generation ship like this. It's all very well for the volunteers who have agreed to go to set off in a voyage like this, but their children and grandchildren haven't volunteered, and they're stuck on this deteriorating environment, possibly condemned to death, quite likely condemned to death, by a decision they had no part in, but was made 100 years or more ago by their grandparents or great-grandparents. So I think that's a very interesting take on the whole generation idea, and it's a very good one. It is morally bankrupt to do that, to send someone off into an environment that you don't know what it's going to be like when they get there, whether it's going to be survivable. And these are people who, because they're born on the voyage, didn't have any say in the setting off. So that's a very interesting theme, and I just wish he had explored it better without so much exposition. One thing which puzzled me was this business about how the ship was launched. The ship was launched from Earth using, what is it, magnetic forces or laser light, or there's some method that they used to launch.
You're quibbling about minor details here, I think.
Okay. No, that's okay. I don't mind that, but that it was the coming back. You know, there's all this business about how difficult it was to launch the ship at speed in the first place. And then they kind of turn around at the other end to come back without the same launch capability, but then can't slow down when they get back to the solar system, which is interesting enough in itself. But I couldn't work out how they got up to speed at the other end. Anyway, that is perhaps a quibble. But so that's fine. And then the thing which really put the kibosh on it for me at the end of the book was this long, I actually counted it in my ebook, 5,200 words, where she goes to the beach and she learns how to body surf and really enjoys body surfing. And that's the end of the book. What? What's wrong with that?
Yes. As I said, he does have a tendency to put his thumb very heavily on one side of the scales here, where he's trying to determine whether humans really should be looking at generation starships and going out to the stars, or whether we should be just trying to fix up what's happening on our own planet. Mm. He does put his hand very heavily on one side, and I'm happy to admit that, but I still enjoyed the book. So,
I say it has interesting themes. I just wish he handled it better. So there you go. So
this whole generation starship stuff is, it's huge. There's a whole lot of stuff that we haven't covered, like the whole of the Gene Wolfe
Book of the Long Ship Sun or something, is it?
The Book of the New Sun. Yeah, the whole of that sequence is all set on a generation starship where basically they it's been going for so long that the inhabitants of the starship have completely lost purpose, so they don't know why they're there, and it's all stratified into lots of different communities, and it becomes like an epic fantasy inside the starship. I mean, fairly brilliantly done, but it's a long haul for you to be able to get there, and you don't know that's happening early on. I don't think this is a spoiler, given that the first book was published 40 years ago, so I think, or maybe even longer, so I think that we can basically safely say, you have to be able to talk about books that are of a certain age, otherwise you just basically, people got to keep up. Yeah. And also, I think a book that I mentioned to you a little while ago, An Unkindness of Ghosts.
Yeah, that looks interesting.
Chris Solomon, which is an attempt to place the whole of the Society of the American South and transpose it onto a generation starship and then see what comes from that. And that was a very interesting book, which is probably only 2 or 3 years old. And so there are younger writers that are also covering some of these themes that have been around for a long time and injecting a whole lot of new life into the genre as they do it. And this is a good thing. Unless you keep up with things and unless you listen to what people are talking about, you aren't going to know that this sort of stuff is available.
Mm.
And that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I think we've been talking long enough. We've been talking for nearly an hour. Let's wind it up. Do we want to talk about what our future plans are? We do have plans in the future. We're hoping that we're going to publish roughly fortnightly in our episodes. So this is about a fortnight since our first one. We also want to talk about books in the future, of course. But we also want to start having interviews with various people, people who have been involved in running science fiction conventions, people who are authors, people who are publishers, a variety of different people. So we have plans along those lines. Do you want to go into any more detail about the interviews that we might do? Or
certainly no, better not, just in case.
Just in case want
people
to do
that will be asked and say, what, are you joking?
Yeah, that's right.
I wouldn't talk to you guys in a blue fit.
Yeah, that's right. let's simply say that it will cover people who have run major events like conventions. It will cover publishers, people who have run small publishing companies. It will include various authors, and we'll see what happens. It should be fun.
Yep. So, but just as a final thing, anything you've been reading just recently that pops up that you think is worthwhile?
What have I been reading? What have I been watching? I haven't watched very much at all. I saw Mortal Engines, the movie based on the Philip Reeve books, which was kind of okay. I like the books a lot. I could talk about those one time, and their prequels. The last kind of really interesting book I read was not science fiction, not even fiction, a non-fiction book called Doing Justice by Preet Bharara. Who's an interesting character. He was the federal district attorney for the Southern District of New York before he was fired by Donald Trump in interesting circumstances, who's now making a living for himself as a very interesting podcaster, interesting guy. He's written a book called Doing Justice, which is all about the justice system in America, with broader application than just America. So that's well worth looking at. That's about all I can think of in the last month anyway.
Well, from my perspective, probably last weekend was the peak of geekdom from the visual media point of view. Day before Anzac Day, so the Wednesday, the first day it opened, I went with the kids to see the Avengers Endgame, massively huge conclusion to a 10-year, 22-movie sequence run by Marvel, which was pretty good. Really enjoyed that. My son actually went to see it again yesterday because he said he just decided there was a whole lot of things. So much happened. He wanted to go back and work out how it all fitted together. And he actually said he enjoyed it better the second time around, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, he's 20, so he's peak audience for this particular thing. If he thinks something's generally all right, it pretty much is and is going to do okay. And it's just going gangbusters, of course. And the other thing that I saw last Monday was the third episode of the last season of Game of Thrones on television. So this big, massive battle for Winterfell, very well handled, bit murky, because it was all filmed at night and there were some sections where there really just wasn't enough light around for the cameras to pick up what was going on. And so a lot of people have complained about the murkiness of it. But overall, it was pretty good. And again, it is coming, bringing things to a big, massive conclusion. So that's going to be interesting. And it's probably worth our while at some point talking about Game of Thrones and The Song of Ice and Fire and George Martin, because it's a fairly major part of modern pop culture. It's bloody everywhere at the moment. I noticed that some of the characters' names from the series are starting to move up in terms of the name counts for the US for girls, which is interesting.
People get called Cersei, do you think?
Not so much Cersei. Arya is a big one that's gone up a long way, I believe. And I want to give a shout out to a couple of other things that I've come across over the last couple of weeks. One was Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising sequence, young adult series from the 1980s. I just read the third book, Green Witch, I think the third of five. It's probably not the best, but it is still pretty good. It brings together a lot of stuff from the first two books and brings it all together, so you can see that two different threads have now come together and are now moving towards a conclusion. That's really quite an excellent series of young adult novels. But also want to give a big shout out to Bruce Gillespie. Bruce is a science fiction fan in Melbourne who has recently published the 50th anniversary edition of his long-running science fiction commentary fanzine. And I mean 50th anniversary in terms of 50 years. So he's gone from 1969 to 2019, which is quite an astounding piece of work. And he's up to about 100 issues, I believe. I think he just didn't quite make 100 issues in his year, though he may try to get to 100 by the end of his 50th year. So that's a fairly massive piece of work over a long sustained piece of work over a long sustained period. And I wanted to give a shout out to him. The copies of his fanzines are available on a eFanzines website. So we'll probably try and put that up onto the show notes as well, so that people can go and have a look. But he's done a fair amount of work.
Excellent. All right. I would like to ask our listeners, all three of you, to please rate us in the iTunes store. Put it 5 stars against it if you're willing. It'll nice, like, write a nice little review. It all helps for us to attract other listeners to the podcast as we go forward. Slight apology for the sometimes poor audio quality of today's podcast. This is the first time we tried to use Skype to record the podcast, and we've had a few issues with that, but we'll get better.